While some cases are solved and others continue to grow cold, there have been some developments in a few cases previously covered on Trace Evidence. A DNA test taken by an unsuspecting woman has shown light into one of the darkest unsolved cases in American history. William Bradford Bishop violently and brutally executed his wife, mother, and three sons on a cold winter evening in March of 1976. Now, more than 40 years later, a woman seeking answers about her own past has unlocked the door to a secret life that no one knew existed. The murder of pediatric nurse Sonia Voroshin shocked the residents of Orangeville, Ontario, Canada, in August of 2010. Despite exhaustive efforts from both the Orangeville and Ontario Provincial Police, the motive and identity of Sonia's killer has never been determined. However, 11 years later, investigators have revealed some new details and their belief that it is only a matter of time. 20-year-old Kelly Berg Dove made three phone calls to police in Harrisonburg, Virginia during the early morning hours of June 18, 1982. Her last call was cut off in mid-sentence, and when police arrived, the young mother was nowhere to be found. For years, police worked to try and identify a suspect to no avail. However, under the leadership of a new investigation, Kelly's case may finally break open. 38-year-old Sandra Solly vanished from Macedon, New York on March 24, 1994. Pregnant at the time, many theorized that Sandra may have gone off on her own to start a new life. However, details at the scene and evidence later found suggested something more sinister had occurred. At the time, Sandra's ex-husband was considered a person of interest. Now, 27 years later, a private investigator believes the truth is not far out of reach. This is Trace Evidence, 4 Case Updates. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today, we're going to explore updates revolving around 4 cases previously covered on the show. Before getting into those, just a few quick notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and disappearances. You can follow the show on social media on Twitter at TraceEvPod, Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or by searching Facebook for Trace Evidence. If you're interested in supporting the show and getting some Trace Evidence merch, there's a Patreon at patreon.com/traceevidence, or you can donate directly via PayPal. Visit trace-evidence.com for all social media links, donation options, and contact information. You can submit case suggestions through the website or email me directly at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. During the process of compiling information for episode 176, I came across something that required further research. Rather than taking a week off, I thought this would be a good time to examine a few smaller but interesting updates on previously covered cases. Hopefully, following new information, these cases will finally find their conclusions. Now, let's get into the cases. Episode 86, The Murder of the Bishop Family. On the morning of Tuesday, March 2, 1976, Wilma Swain was working her shift high atop a watchtower 5 miles south of Columbia, North Carolina. From atop the towering structure, Swain had an unobstructed view for over 40 miles in all directions. Sighting smoke that afternoon, Swain got on the radio and spoke with Ronald Brickhouse, a North Carolina Forestry Service Ranger. Swain directed Brickhouse towards North Carolina Highway 94, approximately 1 mile from her tower. At 1 p.m., Brickhouse located the fire burning just off Burton Shell Road. He quickly realized that he could not control the fire on his own, which, at this point, was burning along nearly 3 acres of brush. Heading back towards his truck to call for backup, Brickhouse made a grisly discovery. In a freshly dug pit, approximately 4 feet deep, Brickhouse saw the charred remains of 2 adult women. In addition to calling in help putting out the fire, Brickhouse notified the sheriff's department of this horrifying sight. When Sheriff Royce Rhodes saw the burned bodies in the hole, he immediately knew his department was going to want assistance, and so he contacted state police, who quickly dispatched 3 agents. Upon their arrival, Agents Louis Young, Lenny Wise, and William Godley began the process of removing the bodies. It was then that they discovered the true horror. There, beneath the two women, were the burned bodies of three male children. The fire had made visual identification of the victims impossible. The women were fully dressed in the remnants of burnt clothing, while the children wore what remained of their pajamas. It was clear that someone had brutally murdered a family and then set a fire to destroy the evidence. However, after the flames had been extinguished, investigators located several vital pieces, including a scorched gas can, a pitchfork, and a shovel. Police also noted that two of the children's heads had been wrapped in towels, believed to have been done by the killer to reduce the amount of blood spilled during transportation. Without any way to positively identify the victims, their bodies were sent to North Carolina Memorial Hospital in Chapel Hill, while investigators began reaching out to surrounding police agencies and schools in search of any missing persons report who might fit the victim descriptions. Unfortunately, the answers they sought were more than 300 miles away, and it would take 5 days before the true extent of this hideous crime was discovered. On Monday, March 8th, Detective Joe Sargent, a police officer in Bethesda, Maryland, was dispatched to investigate a report of a missing family. Approaching the home, Sargent noticed mail spilling out of the box and several unopened newspapers lying on the front step. He also saw what appeared to be spots of blood. Drawing his weapon, Sargent slowly entered the home and began clearing rooms. He found additional spots of blood leading from the doorway to the den and then up a carpeted staircase. As the officer began his climb towards the second floor, he found large spatters of blood on the wall. Reaching the top, Sargent looked towards the partially open door of the master bedroom and saw what he later described as a house of horrors. There was blood everywhere. At that time, he made the decision to exit the home and radio for backup. One of the radio dispatchers, upon hearing Sargent's call, remembered seeing a flyer about five bodies found in North Carolina days earlier. Bringing a copy to the scene, a neighbor who had called in the initial missing persons report positively identified the victims as being the Bishop family. The two women were identified as being Annette, 37 years old, and her mother, Lobelia, 68. The three children were Annette's sons, William, Brenton, and Jeffrey, 14, 10, and 5. Police quickly determined that only one person appeared to be missing, Annette's husband, William Bradford Bishop, Jr. The question soon became, was William also a victim, or had he brutally and viciously murdered his entire family before driving nearly 5 hours to dump and burn their bodies? Bloody fingerprints discovered in the bathroom were later confirmed to be those of William, and for police it seemed apparent that he was in fact their person of interest. Trying to track down the man, investigators learned that Bishop worked for the State Department as the Assistant Chief of Special Trade Activities. Co-workers would report that he had last been seen leaving work on Monday, March 1st, at approximately 5:30 p.m., less than 24 hours before North Carolina authorities found the bodies of his family. Roy A. Harrell, Jr., a co-worker and friend, told police that when he'd last seen Bishop, he seemed to be upset about having been passed over for a promotion at work. No one had seen Bishop since that morning, and soon a massive nationwide manhunt was launched for the man, suspecting of having viciously murdered his wife, mother, and three children by bludgeoning them with a hammer. Investigators quickly tied Bishop to the crime, learning that in the hours after leaving his job that Monday, he had purchased a 2.5-pound miniature sledgehammer, gasoline and a can to store it in, a shovel, and a pitchfork. Police theorized that Bishop had entered the home that evening, first killing Annette and then his own mother. He then proceeded into the children's bedrooms and viciously bludgeoned them in their sleep. Following the murders, Bishop removed the bodies from the home one by one, placing them in his station wagon. Before leaving the house, he took the family dog along for the ride and drove directly to Columbia, North Carolina, where he dug a hole, tossed in the bodies, set the fire, and drove off. All in all, from the time of the murders to the start of the fire, less than 16 hours had passed. Despite multiple sightings being called in, investigators were always a step behind. Then, at 3 p.m. on Thursday, March 18th, a ranger in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park near Gatlinburg, Tennessee, was jotting down the license plate of a seemingly abandoned station wagon when he noticed the clear sight of dried blood. Within 30 minutes, 10 FBI agents arrived to close off the scene and examine the vehicle, which had reportedly been sitting in that space for at least 2 days. Inside, they found a bloody blanket and clothes, shotgun, an axe, maps, credit card receipts, dog treats, and Bishop's prescription medication. While investigators spent the next 12 days searching the sprawling 520,000-acre national park, William Bradford Bishop was nowhere to be found. He has since been on and off the FBI's most wanted list, and for more than 40 years, despite several alleged sightings from New Mexico to Sweden and Italy, he has never been captured or positively identified. No one knows what exactly drove Bishop to murder his entire family in such a savage and gruesome manner. There's been theories, financial troubles, frustration at work, a desire to start a new life, and the growing specter of mental health issues getting out of control. However, the mystery of William Bradford Bishop doesn't end there. There are unanswered questions about how and where Bishop may have spent pieces of his life, leading to speculation that he might have worked for a covert agency, such as the CIA, and if so, may have had multiple identities and possibly multiple families who were completely unaware of one another. Now, 45 years since Bishop murdered his family and vanished, a simple DNA test may have filled in some of the blanks about this vile killer's life. Case update. Kathy Gilchrist grew up 17 miles out of Staunton, Massachusetts. Born in 1957, Kathy's biological mother put her up for adoption, and she ultimately was taken into the home of her parents, Jack and Norma Sidebottom. Kathy was aware that she was adopted, though she told NBC News that she couldn't have selected better parents to be raised by, describing Jack and Norma by saying they were as wholesome as they come. Kathy explained that she didn't know much about her birth parents, only that her mother had handed her over to the New England Home for Little Wanderers not long after her birth. According to Gilchrist, she didn't think very much about her biological parents. It wasn't an area of her life she needed to explore, saying that, at the time, her life felt complete. The way she saw it, while most children were born to their parents who had little say in how they came out, Kathy's parents had chosen her for exactly who she was. That began to change, though, as she grew older and began approaching retirement. No longer located in New England, Kathy's curiosity eventually led her to decide to order a DNA test from 23andMe in 2017. According to her, there was a question on the submission form which gave her the ability to note herself as having been adopted, and if she wanted, she could seek out any potential connections to her biological parents. Why not, she figured. A few weeks later, Kathy received the notification that her DNA had been processed, and she was pleasantly surprised to find she had a match. Susan Gilmore, living in Maine at the time, was identified as being a cousin of Kathy's. The two connected and discussed they shared a lot in common, both physical appearance and in their career choices. Not knowing much about her own family, Kathy wasn't able to answer a lot of questions about how the two were connected, but Susan had a secret. She worked as a genealogist and offered to try and find some of those answers for her newfound cousin. After several months of work, Gilmore managed to locate Kathy's mother, who was living in Maine. Kathy's mother had given up several children for adoption prior to marrying and eventually raising three of her children. Gilmore identified several half-siblings for Kathy, though it appeared that she only shared that bond through her mother, with her being the only child biologically connected to her yet unknown father. His identity would be more difficult, as adoption paperwork showed one name, while hospital records showed another. For Kathy, this meant only one of two things. Either her mother wasn't sure who her father was, or she had purposefully kept his name a secret. Gilmore began building a family tree for Kathy and advised her to submit a DNA test to Ancestry.com, according to NBC, because it has a bigger database and might make the process a little less complicated. Eventually, Gilmore kept finding the same last names in common and similar locations. One name, which appeared several times, was Saint Germain, and following that thread, eventually led to a marriage with someone named Bishop. The couple had only one child together, a son. Eventually, Gilmore uncovered the name William Bradford Bishop Jr. Researching him, she quickly realized that this might not be the answer Kathy had been hoping for. When Gilmore called, Kathy jokingly asked if maybe her father was someone famous. Susan told her that he was, in a manner of speaking, but she didn't want to lay the whole story on her. Instead, she supplied Kathy with the name and suggested that she do some research on her own. It didn't take long to find an answer, as at that time, Bishop was on the FBI's 10 most wanted list. Taking it in stride, and as someone who'd always used humor to deal with hard problems in her life, Kathy later explained to the Charlotte Observer, quote, "I thought, of course my father is a murderer," end quote. Kathy was born in June of 57, 2 years before Bishop married Annette and began a family with her, a family he would later destroy. As it turned out, while Kathy was winning a beauty contest in Staunton just 8 hours away, Bishop was already shopping for the tools he would use to brutalize and dispose of his wife, mother, and 3 boys. At first, Kathy wasn't sure what to believe, but when she saw her father's photograph on the FBI's website, she immediately recognized key features of herself, from their similar noses, smiles, and a shared mole on the side of their face. Wondering if perhaps she could learn more or lend assistance in some way she couldn't possibly fathom, Kathy sent the information of her connection to Bishop to the FBI. Special Agent Karen Cody saw the alert but was skeptical. Countless years had been spent mapping out Bishop's life before his marriage to Annette, and so it didn't seem like there was any room for him to have fathered a secret child. Cody eventually took a sample of Kathy's DNA and compared it to DNA which had been extracted from cigarette butts found in the ashtray of Bishop's station wagon. When the system showed that Kathy was in fact Bishop's daughter, Cody began to realize that this was the first development in the hunt for Bishop in decades. Special Agent Cody explained to NBC, quote, "It opens up a whole new dimension of Bishop's life that we never knew about. And so it does raise the possibility that there may be a reason behind him snapping," end quote. The FBI is hoping to find anyone who may have known Bishop between the years of 57 and 60 in hopes of unlocking what was going on in his life at the time and what he may have been up to. Through the link between Kathy and Bishop, the FBI has now been able to confirm additional living relatives to the infamous killer. Unfortunately, Kathy's birth mother passed away before she could be asked any questions, which may have shed some light on her connection to Bishop and his activities during that time. The hunt for William Bradford Bishop is certainly not over, and now with Kathy's story, the FBI must consider the possibility that Bishop may have other children out there, perhaps born before his monstrous crime, perhaps after. Questions about him potentially living a double life have long been considered, but now that possibility seems perhaps a bit more realistic. Despite the passage of time, FBI Special Agent in Charge Steve Voigt confirmed that the agency was just as interested in finding Bishop today as they were in 1976. Since there has never been confirmation of Bishop being deceased, many, including Kathy, believe he may still be out there, perhaps living in Europe with a new family that has no idea of his past or true identity. If alive today, William Bradford Bishop Jr. would be 85 years old. Bishop is described as a white male with brown eyes and hair, standing 6'1" tall and in 1976 weighing approximately 180 pounds. Bishop speaks 5 languages. He was an experienced outdoorsman and had an amateur's pilot license. He obtained an American Studies degree from Yale University and a master's degree in Italian from Middlebury College. He was a voracious reader and often kept a journal. Suffering from insomnia, Bishop has previously been under psychiatric care and has been prescribed medication for depression. People who knew Bishop described him as intense, self-absorbed, and prone to violent outbursts while maintaining a desire to live and dwell in a neat and orderly environment. He enjoyed scotch and wine and liked eating peanuts and spicy food. Bishop has traveled and lived abroad extensively, with a lot of time spent in Africa and Europe. He was physically active, working out at the gym several times a week, as well as enjoying playing sports, fishing, and riding a motorcycle. Age-progressed photographs of Bishop are available through the FBI's website. Anyone with information is asked to contact their nearest American embassy or consulate or the FBI's Baltimore field office at 410-265-8080. Episode 113, The Abduction of Kelly Berg Dove. 20-year-old Kelly Berg Dove vanished from Harrisonburg, Virginia during the early morning hours of Friday, June 18, 1982. At the time, Kelly was working alone on the overnight shift at the Imperial Gas Station on Route 11. During her shift, Kelly contacted police to report that a male customer had been harassing her, and during this first call, she requested that police come by the station to check on her. Not long after, Kelly made a second call to report the same man. This time, however, she specified that the man had entered the store while dressed improperly, which it's been suggested meant that he had likely exposed himself to the 20-year-old. The third and final call came into dispatch at 2:30 a.m., and this time Kelly's voice clearly indicated that she was upset and frightened. According to Kelly, the same man had returned to the gas station and was using the payphone outside to make inappropriate and harassing calls to her. Kelly described the suspect's vehicle as being a gray or silver car, possibly a Ford. Kelly requested that an officer be dispatched to the station. However, before the call could be completed, a struggling sound was heard and the line went dead. An officer arriving on the scene less than 2 minutes later found the gas station abandoned. A magazine lay open on the counter where Kelly had been standing, and a cigarette she had been smoking was in the ashtray, having burned all the way down. An examination of the store showed there was no evidence of a robbery, nor did they find anything to indicate that a struggle had taken place. Police determined that the abductor could have removed Kelly from the business and forced her into a vehicle to abduct her, a process which they argued could be completed in as little as 15 seconds. Kelly's family described the 20-year-old as a fighter and speculated that her abductor had to have been armed since Kelly hadn't fought back against his attack. While Kelly's family believed she had been specifically targeted by her abductor, police felt this was more likely a crime of opportunity. Investigators noted that the suspect had likely noticed that Kelly was working alone and made his decision to take her spur of the moment. Kelly's sister, who also worked at the gas station, told police that harassing phone calls were somewhat common when working the overnight shift, although it was noted that only one such call came in the 6 weeks after Kelly's abduction. Kelly left behind a 4-year-old daughter, who her family says was the center of her universe. At the time, there was tension between Kelly's family and investigators, with the family believing that the case had been poorly handled from the get-go and that investigative mistakes early on may have made finding Kelly all the more difficult. This may be a legitimate criticism, though I should note that both the state police and the FBI were also assisting on the case. Police did manage to speak to employees of other area gas stations who reported a man committing similar harassing and frightening behavior, including exposing himself to a female employee working the overnight shift. In the nearly 40 years that have passed, neither Kelly nor her abductor have ever been found. Case update. As of the summer of 2020, Harrisonburg police have announced that they are reopening the investigation into Kelly's abduction. Detective Brooke Wetherell, assigned to Kelly's case, discussed the difficulty of trying to go back nearly 40 years to determine how things were handled at the time and what they may be able to glean from the original case files. Asked about the family's argument that the case was poorly handled by the original investigators, Wetherell replied, quote, "Police work was different then. Dispatch times were different then. Response times were different then. The city was made up different then. It starts and ends within 15 minutes, and that has been 15 minutes that have been stretched out into every individual second for decades now. End quote. Detective Weatherwell noted that Kelly was not the first woman to go missing from Virginia during that time in the 80s, and in the years following her abduction, employees at gas stations throughout the state called police to report similar harassment and threatening behavior. Whether or not Kelly's abduction is tied to other cases is unknown for now, but the possibility remains that the suspect may have committed similar crimes. Weatherwell noted that they were missing key pieces of information, which could help finally bring the case to a conclusion. Authorities request that anyone who was in the area in the days leading up to and following Friday, June 18, 1982, contact them with anything they may have seen or heard that was out of the ordinary. No matter how small or silly it may seem, you never know what information might finally break the case open. Kelly's younger sister, Elaine, also spoke to ABC and expressed how difficult it has been for her family, who have lived the previous 40 years not knowing what became of Kelly or who was responsible. While she knows Kelly is likely never coming home alive, she does think an arrest could finally bring some kind of closure and peace to her family, saying, quote, "I know it won't bring Kelly back, but as far as to know that that person is off the streets and we laid her to rest and we know where she's at, it would feel amazing." End quote. When last seen, Kelly Berg Dove was described as being a white female with brown hair and eyes, standing 5 feet, 1 inch tall, and weighing approximately 105 pounds. Kelly wears a partial dental plate in place of her front two teeth. She wears contact lenses or glasses and was a smoker in 1982. She has a scar on the back of her head and a scar on her forehead at the hairline. If you have any information about the abduction of Kelly Berg Dove, please contact the Harrisonburg Police Department at 540-437-2600. Her case number is 1982-681-146. Before getting into the next two updates, let's listen to a quick word from this week's sponsors. Has this ever happened to you? You need to see a doctor. You search and you find one that looks good. You wait on hold to book an appointment. You rearrange your schedule. And when you finally go in, you find out this doctor doesn't even take your insurance. That's very annoying, but there's a solution. ZocDoc. Just download the free ZocDoc app, the easiest way to find a great doctor and instantly book an appointment. With ZocDoc, you can search for local doctors who take your insurance, read verified patient reviews, and book an appointment in person or video chat. Never wait on hold with a receptionist again. Go to ZocDoc.com/trace and download the ZocDoc app to sign up for free. ZocDoc makes healthcare easy. Now is the time to prioritize your health. Go to ZocDoc.com/trace and download the ZocDoc app to sign up for free and book a top-rated doctor. Many are available as soon as today. That's ZocDoc.com/trace. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp Online Therapy. Check out BetterHelp.com/trace. Life is full of stressors. It doesn't matter who you are, what you have, your life is probably stressful. I know for me, it can be challenging to keep up with the demands of work, home, and family life while also trying to find time to unwind, clear my head, and just take a break from the everyday chaos that life throws at you. You may not be feeling down and out and depressed, or like you're at a total loss, but if your stress is high, your temper is shorter than usual, or even if you're starting to feel strain in any of your relationships, you could probably use the chance to unload. And that's what therapy can be. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can start communicating with your therapist in under 48 hours. Unload the stressors and get some unbiased feedback. You'd be pretty surprised at what you might gain from it. See if it's for you. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp, and Trace Evidence listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/trace. That's BETTERHELP.com/trace. As it gets colder, I love finishing my day curled up and cozy on my couch watching TV, especially when the shows are must-watch, like I'm always finding on Eggcorn TV. Eggcorn TV is the largest commercial-free British streaming service that features compelling stories, exclusive premieres, and originals you won't find anywhere else. With Eggcorn TV, there's always something new to discover. It has hundreds of exclusive shows from around the world, including award-winning mysteries, dramas, comedies, and so much more. From production to performances, the series you'll find on Eggcorn TV are exceptional and refreshing because they're cleverly written, visually striking, and feature renowned actors like David Tennant and Thandi Newton. Recently, I've really gotten into Manhunt, which follows Martin Clunes returning as DCI Colin Sutton to investigate a disturbing string of assaults targeting the elderly. The real-life story of the police pursuit of a notorious serial rapist whose 17-year reign of terror left thousands of elderly people in southeast London living in fear. You get thousands of hours of new, enthralling content on Eggcorn TV for a fraction of the cost compared to most streaming services at just $5.99 a month. I love how easy it is to watch. Whether it's on my Fire TV, computer, or on my phone, I can watch anywhere, anytime. Try Eggcorn TV free for 30 days by going to acorn.tv and using my promo code TRACE. But you have to enter the code in all lowercase numbers. That's acorn.tv, code TRACE, to get your first 30 days free. Episode 38, The Murder of Sonia Voroshin. On the morning of Monday, August 30th, 2010, a woman was walking down an alley in Orangeville, Ontario, Canada. This alley, which runs parallel to Broadway, crosses behind the city's town hall, and it was there that the passerby first noticed a white Toyota Corolla parked behind the building. It wasn't necessarily the car which drew her attention, but the state that it was in. Both of the front doors were hanging open, as was the trunk, and there were thick smears of blood drying on the rear bumper. Frightened, the woman immediately called police, who arrived at the scene moments later. As investigators began sweeping the vehicle for evidence, they were able to run down the plate and determine that the owner was Sonia Voroshin, a 42-year-old nurse who lived in a townhouse on Spring Street, approximately a 5-minute walk from where the car was found. Upon their arrival at the home, investigators were given access by the landlord, noting that there were no signs of forced entry. However, once inside, police discovered a large quantity of blood and obvious signs of a struggle. At the time, they weren't sure if they were looking at a kidnapping or a murder. Canvassing the area, police found only one neighbor who reported being awoken during the night by the sounds of screams and screeching car tires. A large-scale search was launched utilizing over 100 law enforcement officials, tracking dogs, and helicopters. But 24 hours later, there was no sign of the missing woman. Desperate for answers, law enforcement issued a plea through the media for locals to come forward with anything they may have seen that night. Unfortunately, what tips they did receive gave them no greater insight into the case. On Wednesday, September 1st, following a forensic analysis of Sonia's car and home, investigators declared that she was likely the victim of a homicide. They requested that locals look through their property for anything suspicious or out of the ordinary as they searched for Sonia's body. Asked about the investigation, police had little to offer other than noting that while they'd begun the investigation under the assumption that this crime had been random, they were now leaning more towards the likelihood that Sonia had been targeted by someone she may have known. Investigators also told the media that beige-colored bedding was missing from Sonia's home. Police theorized that the killer had gained entry to the house and murdered Sonia before using her own car to transport her body to an unknown location before bringing it back and abandoning it in Orangeville. Investigators stated that the suspect would have been covered in a significant amount of blood that night. On Sunday, September 5th, 1 week after Sonia was last seen alive, her body was found wrapped in her missing bedding by a man walking his dog on Beach Grove Side Road near Mountain View Road in the town of Caledon, approximately 13 kilometers east of Orangeville. While police were extremely tight-lipped about any evidence found, they did note that a men's size 10 or 11 bloody work boot print was found, though they wouldn't say if this was at the car, the townhouse, or near the dump site. They also specified that the killer was likely someone very familiar with Orangeville and its surrounding areas, as well as Sonia's townhouse and likely Sonia herself. To date, her cause of death has never been released. Even Sonia's family don't know how the 42-year-old was killed. Months passed with little headway made until a new detective was put in charge of the investigation. In subsequent interviews, it was revealed that Sonia may have met her killer through a dating app. In addition, reporters were told that police possessed the killer's DNA, though they wouldn't say in what form it had been found. Over the course of the next 7 years, investigators collected more than 600 DNA samples from men in the area and had tracked down more than 1,000 tips they'd received, but it was all to no avail. A rift developed between Sonia's family and investigators over the lack of information they had shared, but inspectors noted that it was crucial to the investigation that they keep as much of the detail as they could under wraps. Case update. While the investigation into Sonia's murder has been, for the most part, quiet over the past few years, investigators did reveal new information in this past year. Inspector Sean Glassford of the Ontario Provincial Police sat down for an interview with the Toronto Sun in August of 2020. During this interview, Glassford discussed several details of the case which, up until that point, they had chosen not to reveal. For instance, the FBI had been asked for assistance early on to develop a profile of the killer, but the police had never shared any of the insights that were learned. Now, Glassford stated that the killer's actions had been very brazen. Following the murder, when he would have been covered in blood, he ran the risk of being seen by using Sonia's own vehicle to transport her. It's believed he likely dumped the car behind Town Hall because he'd parked his own vehicle nearby, and he likely would have felt comfortable to provide a reason for his presence in that area if someone had come along. Sonia's townhouse on Spring Street was described as being partially hidden behind a neighborhood, in that it was unlikely someone just driving by randomly would even notice the complex, which suggested the killer had been there before, or at a minimum, somehow was aware of its presence. Glassford noted that behind the complex, there were several paths leading through a wooded area which could connect to downtown Orangeville, and it was entirely possible the killer had made his way through this wooded area the night of the murder. Again, it was believed the killer likely lived in Orangeville and knew it extremely well. In a YouTube video produced by the police, one investigator noted that while the killer clearly knew and targeted Sonia, it was entirely possible that she did not know him at all. Another new piece of information was that, in addition to possessing the killer's DNA, authorities are also in possession of a piece of surveillance footage from that night. According to Glassford, who wouldn't get too specific, the video is believed to show Sonia's car being driven by her killer, passing through parts of Orangeville on the night of the crime. Unfortunately, it seems that video has not provided investigators with a clear image of the person behind the wheel that night. It was noted, though, that since the killer had left the car abandoned in an obvious location with the doors and trunk open, he may have wanted the car to be found for reasons that are not yet known. Constable Scott McLeod, who has since retired, explained in a video produced by authorities that the DNA sample collected allowed them to create a small profile of a male perpetrator, though they have not yet gotten any hits. This implies that the killer has never had his DNA taken by police before, suggesting he's never been arrested before or since. However, there has been some speculation that the suspect may also have died in the years since committing the murder. According to Inspector Glassford, detectives have been assigned to Sonia's case since the first day of the investigation and continue, 11 years later, to work on it daily. Though he wouldn't specify how many DNA samples have been collected since 2017, it was stated that DNA collection is ongoing. He also said that advances in technology have been utilized to test samples and that they are in a better place now with their ability to use DNA than they had been at the time of the murder. While he wouldn't go into much detail, Glassford did acknowledge that they've considered using DNA phenotyping to create a digital composite of what Sonia's killer may have looked like. In recent years, familial DNA has been used to identify previously unknown suspects in multiple crimes. Glassford stated that they could collect the DNA of families of deceased suspects in order to rule them in or out. Asked whether or not they believe Sonia's killer had killed before or since, Glassford responded that he couldn't know that for certain, but he did look forward to asking the suspect directly once they track him down. Investigators also stated that while more than a decade has passed, the difference in time doesn't necessarily work against them. Speaking to Toronto.com, Glassford said that the passing time may actually help them, as they believe there are people who know details about the crime who have not yet come forward, and perhaps as relationships and interactions evolve, someone will finally feel safe or comfortable enough to tell investigators what they know. In order to keep the case in the public eye, authorities do maintain and continue to put up flyers regarding Sonia's case, and they believe they will track down and identify the man who committed this heinous crime sooner than later. A $50,000 reward for information leading to the conviction of Sonia's killer remains available. Anyone with information is asked to contact the Orangeville Police at 519-941-2522. You can also contact the Ontario Provincial Police at 1-888-310-1122 or Crime Stoppers at 1-800-222-8477. Episode 141, The Disappearance of Sandra Solly. 38-year-old Sandra Ann Solly was last seen at the Ames Shopping Plaza on Route 31 in Macedon, New York, on Tuesday, May 24, 1994. At the time, no one was aware that Sandra was missing, and as a result, she wasn't reported as a missing person until nearly 2 weeks later on June 5th, when her landlord contacted family after the 38-year-old failed to pay her rent and could not be located. When police entered the apartment, they found no signs of a struggle, but noted both Sandra's car and all of her clothing had been left behind. Missing with Sandra was her dog, a black poodle named Jessie. At the time, Sandra was pregnant and very much looking forward to the birth of her child. She missed a baby shower, which her family had planned for her, and investigators didn't believe she would have done so if she'd had the choice. Operating under the assumption that something may have happened to her while walking her dog, police launched massive searches of the area around her apartment. These searches were conducted on land and from the sky, utilizing police on foot and ATVs. Behind Sandra's apartment was a canal, and divers were brought in to go into the water in search of her, but nothing was ever found. Investigators went through Sandra's address book and answering machine, conducting interviews with everyone she knew. While they had no evidence at the time, police told the media they believed her disappearance was suspicious. Approximately a week later, police tracked down three men who had been using Sandra's credit cards in the Rochester area. When brought in for questioning, investigators learned that one of the men's sons had discovered Sandra's wallet discarded in shrubs along North Street in Rochester. Unfortunately, despite several searches in the surrounding area, police were unable to locate anything else, and it was believed Sandra's abductor had likely tossed her wallet out of his car window while driving through. Around this same time, police were dispatched to a car wash in Penfield, approximately 13 miles northwest of Macedon, along a route towards Rochester. In a dumpster behind the business, police located both Sandra's purse and Jesse's dog collar with tags still attached. Police theorize that her abductor may have gone through the car wash in order to erase evidence from his vehicle before disposing of the items in a garbage can, which employees then put into the dumpster. While this discovery caused additional searches, nothing of significance was found. Police began focusing in on Sandra's ex-husband, Ralph Solly Jr. There were rumors at this time that, following their divorce and Ralph's remarriage to another woman, Sandra's former hairstylist, that the former couple had begun having an affair. Several people suggested that Ralph was, in fact, the father of Sandra's unborn child, and to add to the chaos, Ralph's new wife gave birth to a child just 5 days after Sandra vanished. Police interviewed Ralph multiple times, and he did admit to seeing his ex the day she disappeared, though he alleged it was well before the time of her last official sighting. After two interviews with Ralph, police reported that he arrived for his third accompanied by a lawyer, and when asked to take a polygraph, he refused to do so. Unfortunately, at the time, Sandra's case began growing cold. Richard Ingram, a private investigator, learned of Sandra's case and, after contacting the family, began his own investigation. Over the course of the next 27 years, Ingram worked on the case both on his own and along with state investigators. Several other searches were conducted, both near her apartment and at the car wash where her purse was found, but nothing was discovered. Then, in October of 2016, police were finally able to search a parcel of land previously owned by Ralph, but as had been the case with every other search, nothing was found. Case update. 27 years have passed since Sandra Solly mysteriously disappeared from her Macedon, New York home, and now private investigator Richard Ingram believes they may be closing in on the truth. Speaking to ABC News, Ingram stated his belief that Sandra had likely gotten into a car with someone she knew and believed she could trust, and that person was ultimately responsible for her disappearance. According to Ingram, he has recently received a tip which he considers promising, though he warns that previous tips had only led to letdown, but this one he thinks is different. The exact nature of the tip has not been disclosed, with Ingram saying he was reticent to share too much detail this early. However, for the first time in 27 years, the experienced investigator believes they may be onto something. Ingram explained, quote, "The new information looks good. Something might be breaking soon, I hope. It might be days, weeks, or months, but something is working." End quote. While there is no way of knowing for certain, some speculation has broken out about the nature of this tip, noting that while Ingram discussed this new information with reporters in late May of 2021, Sandra's ex-husband Ralph passed away less than 2 weeks later on Friday, June 4th. At the time of his death, Ralph was living in St. Augustine, Florida, and had suffered from pancreatic cancer and lymphoma. Whether or not this new tip ties to Ralph, or perhaps someone else as of this time, is unknown, but I will, as always, keep tabs on the case in hopes of a future update. When last seen, Sandra Ann Solly was described as being a white female with brown hair and eyes, standing 5 feet 5 inches tall and weighing approximately 140 pounds. Sandra's ears are pierced. She has a birthmark on her abdomen and a scar on her upper lip. At the time of her disappearance, Sandra was 6 to 7 months pregnant. She was last seen in Macedon, New York on May 24, 1994, and if alive today, would be 65 years old. If you have any information about Sandra's disappearance, please contact the New York State Police at 585-398-4123. John Stubb, senior investigator of the Major Crimes Unit, is in charge of her investigation, and the case number is ENEW940151. Four big cases, four small updates. That's how it works sometimes. It takes a lot of pieces to put the whole puzzle together. For the sake of everyone involved, we can only hope that these new directions and pieces of information will be the catalysts for major developments and, hopefully, arrests and answers. So I hope you didn't mind this week's small break from the normal format. Normal episodes will return next week on Tuesday the 19th, and judging from what I've seen so far, you will not want to miss this one. Trace Evidence would not be possible without support from amazing listeners like you. And now I'd like to take a moment to thank our fantastic Patreon producers, Alicia Lorraine, Anne Bertram, Brittany Bivens, Christine Greco, Dave Allen, Denise Dingsdale, Diane Dyson, Eamon Brady, Eric Sumpter, Heather Louise, James, Jennifer Winkler, Jill Sense, Joni Berkowitz, Kara Moreland, Lars Jensen Fangel, Leslie B., Marla Wright, Melissa Brickeisen, Nick Mohar Schurz, Quinn McBreen, Robert Jansen, Sarah Levinen, Travis Skepko, Stephanie Joyner, Stephanie Eve, Taylor, Tom Archer, Tom Radford, and Tracy Woods. Your contributions to Trace Evidence are invaluable, and your support of the show is both appreciated and extremely humbling. If you're interested in supporting Trace Evidence and gaining access to exclusive merch and ad-free episodes, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence or go to trace-evidence.com and click on the support option. That's going to conclude this week's update episode, looking at four cases which, while not yet solved, are showing promise that the answers may be coming. So thank you for listening, and I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.